Lunch with Leon.
Hello and welcome to Lunch with Leon, episode 106. Thanks very much indeed for joining us again this episode. Do you know, it's always nice to have people back, and even nicer when they've got a new job and one that they're absolutely made for. So welcome back to Lunch with Leon, Ben Plowden. He was with us back in 2021. My goodness me, that's a long time ago. Episode 50, if you want to go back. He's now chief executive at the Campaign for Better Transport. And as we hear on the media quite often, I asked him about his first 100 days.
I just checked before we came on air, Leon. I think this is week 11, day three of, not that I'm counting. So, yeah, I think I'm technically still in my probation period, but it's been a fantastic, you know, fantastic couple of months. I have to say, great organisation, great time to be doing this job. Very interesting challenges ahead of us, I think. But yeah, so yeah, I think I'm still in the early days of the new role. I hope so anyway.
and look, if ever there was a job written for anybody, this job was written for you, wasn't it? I mean, this is everything you've ever wanted to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. There's a very kind of nice symmetry about it, I guess. As you know, I began my career in the voluntary sector campaigning sort of set up and then transformed what was a pedestrians association, turned into Living Streets. Spent about 20 years at Transport for London, learning about the political and practical realities of actually doing better transport in a real place with real stakeholders and real challenges. And then spent a couple of years in consulting, which is another perspective on the same set of issues. And then coming back kind of full circle to a kind of, you know, an advocacy role on a topic which I spent, like you, my whole career thinking about and doing, been absolutely fantastic. So there's a very nice sort of shape to that, not unintended shape, by the way. I can't pretend it was the result of a great plan, but it's been an amazing experience to kind of come back to this world, all the same world, I guess, but looking at it through a slightly different prism.
You and I both loved what we did in TfL. We're still loving what we do, which I think is some sort of, how can I say, it's a way to stay young and alert and healthy and so on. There's definitely a mental health benefit to having a sort of real sense of purpose. I don't like mean just doing any job, but doing something you're really, really passionate about. I mean, it must be tremendous to be loving every minute of it.
Yeah, no, for sure. And like you, my working life has really all been about trying to, it sounds very pious if one isn't careful, but, you know, leaving the world physically, socially, economically, environmentally a better place than one found it. And obviously it's very hard to detect whether one's actually having any impact as an individual, but nonetheless being involved in the process of doing that with other like-minded, talented, passionate people is such a privilege, I think. So yeah, and the opportunity to do this version of that at this point in my career has been extraordinary. So yeah, no, I'm really pleased to be in this place.
So I'll tell you what's frightening me a bit at the moment. The feeling we had at the time of the general election and the change of government, that we would see quite a bit of change in what you and I would regard to be in the right direction, like more public transport, less private motoring, and so on. I guess I'm a bit worried that in the wider politics, the green agenda just seems to be softening a bit. The whole movement with reform and the whole, you know, global warming is a myth and all the stuff that goes with it. I guess I'm feeling a bit concerned that all the remarkable stuff that's been done so far about decarbonisation and so on, which is just, in my world, just a subset of making the place nicer anyway, because, you know, a city full of zero emission cars is still a city going nowhere. Do you feel like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you kind of put your finger on it really, Leon, which is that the huge benefit of the decarbonisation agenda is that the sort of transport system that would deliver it, the sort of society that would be underpinned by that transport system, would have multiple attractions, right? I mean, it would be a safe, green, probably more locally oriented, calmer, you know, lots of adjective you could come up with. I think the critical thing, well, three things. One is to not stop talking about the significant threat that climate change poses to all of us. And there's a very interesting post on LinkedIn the other day by a senior figure from the insurance industry. So we know, kind of senior figure in the global economy, saying capitalism is basically going to come to a shuddering halt because you won't be able to insure anything, because all the risks that climate change presents will make many things, agriculture, construction, transport, other infrastructure, uninsurable. At which point, you know, that conversation is still going on, I think. But I think it's very important to use a kind of American political science term, frame the benefits of a decarbonized economy in language and in terms that resonates with people. So that's the second point, I think. So as long as you're talking about the outcomes that you'll get in ways that land in communities that are currently feeling financially pressed, that are not feeling connected to the economy and not feeling connected to wider society, in ways that make clear that their opportunities will be significantly increased, their quality of life will be significantly improved in a world that are decarbonized, I think is critical. And the third thing is really to be scrupulously careful about planning the transition. What do I mean by that? We just published a report, Campaign for Better Transport, in partnership with the trade union Unison, looking at how you transition home care workers from a very car dependent way of working, many of whom actually can't really afford to run a car because they're typically on relatively low wages, to more lower carbon, more sustainable transport. Because unless you can explain to people who would otherwise be adversely affected by this transition how that's going to be okay, they will understandably be extremely concerned about that, and that is potentially open to, you know, exploitation by people who want to exploit it. So the remedy there was, can we, you know, really simple stuff like, can we roster home care working so that people don't have to travel so far?
I think I remember Wigan was one where
Yeah,
they
exactly.
reorganized
Yeah,
the
it's all about
districts.
rostering, you know, not rocket science. Actually, re reduces cost, reduces time, increases time spent with clients in their homes. Then, can we provide, you know, alternative forms of transport, for example, incentives to buy or lease an electric car? Is there scope for e-bikes in geographies where that makes sense? So, but it was a very important report because it was about the need to transition a particular community of, in this case, care workers, from current ways of working and traveling to a new way of working and traveling that would have benefits for them, but also hugely benefit in terms of carbon. So I think, I suppose my third point is, we've got to be really careful about planning and delivering the transition so that people are ideally better off and certainly no worse off than they are in the current situation.
And the other one, I guess, that is worrying me a little bit. Lots of talk, as we know, and indeed our old boss is in charge of it, effective renationalisation of the railways.
Yeah.
And I guess, and he and I have talked about this too. In fact, the Lord Hendy has been a guest on this very show. Is that it's there's a real danger of it becoming a bit engineering focused. The one thing
Sure.
you can say about the privatised railway was that there was, until they were all on management contracts, there was real effort to improve the revenue side. And by revenue, that was about luring people, especially from domestic air,
Yeah.
and also from private car. I guess I'm a little bit worried on the railways that we're going to get a bit closer to a sort of engineering-led technology, using better sorts of steel, having cleverer signalling to go faster type things, and slightly lose the luring the customer onto the product.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that both Secretary of State that we've had since the election, Lou Hague and now Heidi Alexander, have made very clear that certainly from the government's point of view, putting the customer, the passenger, at the heart of what GBR does, how it thinks, how it acts, what it prioritises, is fundamental. And which is sort of obvious, really, because if you don't do that, then people aren't going to see any benefit from the fact that track gets laid more cheaply at 4 o'clock in the morning just outside Rotherham. Although that's beneficial, isn't going to make people feel better about using the railway. So either the current passengers or potential future passengers. So I think it's absolutely fundamental. And I think that the interesting question for me, and you and I will know this from having been involved with organizational changes on a significantly smaller scale in Transport for London, is this is a very, very substantial organizational change project, where you're, you know, moving thousands of people into a new organization. You're designing that organization, you're transitioning people into the new organization, you're thinking, one hopes, very hard about organizational culture as well as about the technicalities of how the organization does what it does. At the same time as people out here are assuming that things are going to get better really quite quickly. And so, how you kind of do that transition as quickly as possible, so that you have a functioning organization once the legislation is in place that can demonstrably start improving how it feels to be on the railway network. And I'm sure that Peter, who you mentioned, is thinking very hard about how to do that as soon as possible, even ahead of the legislation, right? So how could you demonstrably show that the model that will be in place once GBR exists is already starting to produce benefits? And so I think, and I'm sure that lots of clever people are thinking very hard about that, because if I'm a current rail customer or a potential rail customer, and there's no visible improvement in the service I'm being offered, I might be a little bit patient, but I probably won't be patient for indefinitely. So I think thinking about how to get this stuff going better for customers, both passengers actually and freight operators, which is the other critical part of the network, is going to be really important. And you're right, what we would kind of call the culture of the new organization, who it thinks it's working for, how it needs to work for them, I think is going to be really, really fundamental.
Indeed. And as I say, that's my biggest worry, because I think deep in the heart of the ordinary voting public, I think they think what they're going to get are cheaper fares. And fundamentally, there might be some rail fare reform in order to reduce the complexity. I'm not entirely sure that the scope to simply reduce fares at a stroke exists anywhere in the economic matrix of the railways, does it?
Well, it's a very interesting question, isn't it? So I've been talking about this with the team at Campaign for Air Transport. So I think the renationalisation of rail operations is a very interesting opportunity to sort of reframe, to use that phrase again, how we think and talk about what this system is there to do. So for us, transport is a fundamental public service, right? It physically and operationally kind of underpins the economy. The fact that the Victorian Railways kind of created our cities and our city regions, basically society reflects the dominant transport technology of the day, doesn't it? And so there's very interesting the language around subsidy in relation to public transport operations, because we don't subsidize teachers' salaries, we don't subsidize nurses' salaries, we invest in health and education. Now, the health service have to generate some of its income from commercial sources, and you and I debated this endlessly at Transport Fund. So roughly speaking, there are three places that GBR can get money from: passengers through fares, the taxpayer through investment from the Treasury and DfT, and other sources of commercial revenue. So there's a very important debate to be had about what the proportion should be of those three sources of revenue for a viable, financially viable railway, national railway network. But it seems to me that particularly once you've renationalised these services, there is a legitimate conversation about what role taxpayers should play in ensuring that those services are safe, reliable, integrated, all the things that customers want from the service. So yes, I think people may expect fares to drop dramatically. We've said that there should be a fares freeze until the fares system has been thoroughly reviewed. We're quite interested in capping, for example, peak fares. We're quite interested in making sure that people aren't penalised for buying a ticket just before they get on a train, where you can sometimes pay very substantial fares, a very substantial premium. So I think looking at both, to your point, the compositionality of the fare system, and also looking at its affordability in broad terms is critical, because we know from our research that the affordability and complexity of the fare system is one of the big things which determines whether people use rail or not. So I do think that's a conversation that needs now to happen about, what would an affordable fare structure look like and a simplified fare structure look like.
And I'm going to say, because you and I have talked about this endlessly, because it was a hobby horse of mine when we were working together, I am still fascinated by how ordinary shoppers in supermarkets can make very complex retail choices over quality, quantity, price, and availability to go to the checkout literally with a basket that represents their best value for money choices across a range of products, but seemingly only want there to be one train fare from London to Manchester. I am always surprised that humans that are capable of such sophisticated choices, people who research online for the cheapest deal, people that go to those websites that tell you where the price of petrol is cheapest and trade off cheaper petrol versus how much petrol you use to get there, suddenly have this blind spot when it comes to rail fares, because you would argue that there is a rail price matrix that's designed to suit the pockets and the needs of nearly everybody, including whether they're 16 to 25, 26 to 30, old, former members of the military, or have to go at no notice to Newcastle on a peak time train. Every time I hear simplification, it will mean less choice. And that less choice will, there'll be disbenefits in the less choice.
But there must be a sweet spot, Martin, there, between four, I'm making this up, four fares and the alleged 50 million that they currently are on the network, right? And I suspect it's going to be closer to 4 than 50 million. And I think that's the point, really, that we need, whether led by the DfT currently or up by GBR in due course, there needs to be a sort of conversation about what is the optimal fare structure where you're trying to balance between revenue generation for the operator, in this case GBR, choice for customers, simplicity of understanding for customers, new or potential. So yeah, I think it's a really good point, and I don't know exactly what the answer is, but there are lots of clever people, including, TfL, have been thinking about this, as we know, for a long, long time. What's the kind of optimal fare structure to meet those different requirements? So yeah, but I think that's a really important part of the debate that now needs to ensue.
And you'll remember my time of advocating the single bus fare in London should be pegged to a medium latte in Starbucks.
Yeah.
Because if you'll pay £3.70 for a paper cup with some hot water and coffee in it, why wouldn't you pay that for an hour's bus travel? And why wouldn't that price move with inflation and stay in the same relative position? Because,
Yeah, to your point, and I guess that brings us back to your point, which is that the more you can align how people think about rail fares and the transport fares more generally with the decisions that they make every day in the supermarket or when they're booking a holiday, I think is a good one, you know.
yeah. I think, look, the other thing I think you did brilliantly, and it is amazing what France has done. Firstly, the sort of multiple cities of RER type services, which is amazing. And the other one, which I don't think gets enough airplay, which is there really just isn't domestic air travel for short distances in France. I can't remember what the cutoff is. Is it 2 hours
Two
or
and a
something?
half hours in theory is early. Yeah, you're not allowed to.
Yeah, indeed. So
Yeah.
you could you. If it's from the deep south, if it's from Marseille to somewhere in the north or something, there's probably an air service. But in general, short domestic flights like we have in the UK, the sort of Manchester's, Edinburgh's of this world, just don't happen in France. Firstly, they're not allowed to happen, and secondly, there is an effective high-speed rail service instead.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I think my understanding is that we've actually had that experience ourselves on the East Coast Main Line. I think there's been a dramatic shift in the mix of travel between London and Edinburgh, between air and rail, precisely for that reason. And it seems to me that selling the kind of value in transit benefits of, what would be a short haul flight vis-a-vis a rail service, your time is much more productively spent on a train. You get on at one end, you can do whatever you want, read a book, review that report, do your emails. If you're there, if you're traveling during work time, for example, there's none of that having about in terminals and in and out of baggage control and so on and so forth. So I think both the journey time benefits, but also the quality and the value of the time spent traveling, I think is something which the rail industry, it does it through its promotions, but I think it's really important to sell because, particularly if you're traveling for business or traveling in work, that's incredibly useful time, right? But you otherwise spend queuing up in various places at an airport,
Yeah.
both going in and coming out.
Well,
And you might, yeah.
and you and I lived through the period, didn't we, where the value of time, as measured from by the department, considered the journey dead time, in now into productive time, for the very reason that you describe. Because
Yeah, and
it can.
I've even heard it said that people are quite upset that the journey time between London and Paris has been reduced because certainly those going there for business, well, I've got less time to hold on, wait a second. That was just enough time to read that draft report. And so yeah, there's a real paradox here, which is that not only is that time valuable, actually people like it as a sort of, subject to your mobile phone not going off and annoying everybody else. It's really high quality time,
Yeah, indeed.
where you're not being interrupted, where you can, wrap your head in a proverbial towel and think about something quite, so I think it's a really important advantage which we need to promote and support.
But look, the other thing which I commend listeners to your report on this in France, that France is talking about RER schemes in cities which are the equivalent of Portsmouth, Peterborough, and Swansea, which would just is just unheard of. In UK, we're fighting to get funding for much more basic type schemes than that. And the fact that France is looking, on the one hand, to really constrain the intercity traffic by air, and is looking to develop RER type services in these cities, so that when you get there, you've also then got the connectivity to other parts of the place where you want to go. I think is exceptionally good, and it is remarkable that they're pushing ahead.
And I think the kind of both the what I'd call the intercity and, sorry, sorry, geeky language, intra-regional rail connectivity benefits of that are crucial. So interesting seeing the two northern mayors, I think, today calling for for a link, a proper link between Liverpool and Manchester, which essentially would then become a single substantial city region, right? And that would have the same effect that the Elizabeth line has had on London, the wider southeast. So yeah, I think understanding the kind of, again, what transport nerds call the agglomeration benefits of better rail connectivity within and between city regions is absolutely fundamental. And as we were saying a minute ago, you know, the Victorian railways created the Victorian city regions, didn't they? And so the same, what's the 21st century equivalent of that process whereby you're putting what looked like quite large sums of public money on the table to produce dramatic benefits? And if, for example, you know, as I understand it, the Northumberland line reopening has generated five times as much use as the most optimistic forecast in the business. Well, I mean, that's not going to be true everywhere, but nonetheless, it suggests that there are substantial opportunities, to your point, for even places that don't look like major cities to substantially increase sort of regional connectivity through rail and tied in then obviously with, you know, the last mile bus walk cycle so that your whole journey is just easier, simpler, quicker, less painful.
We've often talked about this. The biggest problem in our system, in my view, is that transport is just seen as a dead cost. And
Sure.
it's funded through the Department for Transport. All the benefits to society, the economy goes to the Treasury. The health service goes to health. To education goes to education. You know, social services, all the beneficiaries, everybody who's got lower costs or better productivity or better outturn, that's anywhere other than in the Department for Transport, which is where the cost sits. And we don't have a proper mechanism, do we, for
Quite.
effectively rewarding the taxpayers' investment in transport in its widest sense
Yeah.
from the economic benefits which are captured elsewhere
Yeah.
and kept elsewhere.
Well, the one exception to that is the way that we use the Community Infrastructure Levy to part fund Crossrail Elizabeth line. So there was a, you know, a very direct relationship between the predictable economic benefits that would arise from investing in that railway to generate the funds to put it in place in the first place. So I think you're exactly right. Thinking, and it's a kind of, again, quite a technical thing about kind of public sector finance, isn't it? But thinking creatively about how you capture the benefits in other departments, in other parts of the economy, in other sectors from the investment that you make in transport. But there's this, you know, stark statistic that Transport for the North came up with from their report about social exclusion in the north. 30% of the population of the northern region suffer from what they call transport-related social exclusion. That's a massive group of people who can't lead fulfilling, economically productive, socially rewarding lives because the transport choices that they have are poor or indeed non-existent, particularly if they don't own and use a car. So thinking, and that's why we're stressing repeatedly the critical importance of transport investment, both capital and revenue, what we call revenue investment, to underpin the government's five missions, to deliver improved regional productivity, to reduce the productivity gap, to improve people's life chances, to improve public health. These benefits are massive, need to be predicted and quantified, and then, to your point, in some way rolled back into the system that produced them in the first place.
You raise something else in my mind there, which is in general, I'm optimistic about young people because young people are technically savvy, probably come from a greener end of the spectrum, are probably more thoughtful, careful about the planet and so on than older people are. But there is the countervailing bit of that, and it's a bit like long-term unemployment in certain regions. When you get, if time goes on long enough and successive generations of people have become car dependent, then there's then that then their mindset is car dependent. And indeed, as listeners will know, I've been doing quite a bit of work in Azerbaijan, which is one of those former Russian states where every adult has a car, even if it's a banged up old Toyota, because culturally that's what you do. So they're trying to embark on a reduction in car traffic calming, better highway engineering, more pedestrianisation, improved public transport, and so on, which is where the green agenda is quite tricky because, of course, it's rich in gas. But of course, it is just culturally over generations that the moment you reach the minimum age, you get some banged up old car, because that's you. That's your ticket to being an adult. And so, what worries me again in the UK is that if we just let some of these things drift, the younger people will be institutionalized in car dependency,
Sure.
which is one of the
So,
reasons to work hard on it now.
yeah, although I think I'm right in saying that if you look at the data in the National Travel Survey, both owning and using cars, and this is going to be true, I think, historically, but is l lower even than that in younger age groups than in older age groups, and is staying lower as they move through the age range, right? So there's some sign that we're doing the right thing. But it's interesting. I mean, I have two adult daughters who were brought up in Southwest London, both of whom are learning to drive because they just sort of feel it's a useful thing to know how to do. I think it's vanishingly unlikely that either of them will ever buy a car. They just want to be able to use a car on the occasions when that's the best thing that they need to do. And the reason for that is because they were hugely fortunate in growing up in an area where fantastically good public transport. They both cycle because we put them through the cycle training. They're both confident enough to, be out and about after dark on public transport. Everything that we needed, they needed, was within a pretty short walk of our front door, and if not, they could jump on a bus or cycle. So for me, the question is, how do you give young people, or indeed any person, the equivalent range of choices, irrespective of their geography? Now, clearly, what happens in Morpeth or a hill farming community in Wales is not going to be the same as what you might offer people in south of London. Nonetheless, thinking about how could we broaden the kind of menu of choices that people confront when they think about doing their daily things, so that they've got a properly meaningful range of choices, which might include using a car, either a household car or a car share or car hire. But that's because that's the best choice for that particular purpose on that particular occasion. And I think the more we can think about that kind of broadening that menu across geographies, the more likely we are to deal with that problem you've just
Yeah.
identified.
So coming up soon then, you've got a big event. In fact, you've got a whole week of a big event.
Yes, Better Transport Week. Now that is very importantly a celebration, and we use the word overtly, of the amazing stuff that's going on all over the country to plan, deliver, and operate what we call better transport, because it's quite easy to kind of think, oh, it's all very difficult and can't do it here, or it's too expensive. But there's some amazing stuff going on all over the country. So both the conference that we have at the end of that week, but also lots of site visits and public events during the course of the week, are absolutely about celebrating the transport. And the theme this year is about kind of better transport that connects people and communities, because the whole idea of connectivity and connecting people to the things and the people they need to be connected to, which is what transport does, which is why it's so important for the economy, is seems to me a very, very important theme. So it's a positive week, celebrating the great stuff that's going on, and in particular celebrating the role of transport in the increasing access of people to other people, to jobs, to shopping, to culture, whatever it is they want to connect to. So yeah, it's going to be great. The last 2 years have been really successful. This year's bigger and better than ever. So we look forward to everyone coming along and joining in.
Sure do. So it's the 16th to the 22nd of June.
It is.
And I think if people go to your website, there's all sorts of ways that organizations and individuals can get involved and participate
Indeed.
or enjoy the benefit about what's being put on, right?
Precisely, yeah. And then there's a conference at the end of the week in Manchester. So we're going to bring it all together then, which hopefully will be another celebration of what's going on.
Indeed. And Manchester, a great place to go,
Sure.
where the commissioner, of course, is our old friend,
Yes,
Dermot Everett.
absolutely. And again, the stuff that Andy Burnham and Vernon are doing with their incredible team up there really demonstrates how quickly and effectively you can improve local circumstances, to put it no more subtly than that, but by investing in affordable, accessible, integrated, visible public transport and walking, cycling, alongside the availability of fuel efficient or zero carbon cars, if that's what you need to do on a particular occasion. So I think it's a very important, what they're doing there is great and well worth celebrating.
No, indeed. Well, I look forward to that in Manchester at the end of that week. I mean, Manchester, a great place to go if people haven't been recently, because it does not look like Coronation Street opening credits anymore, does it? It is modern. There's fabulous facilities for pedestrians and for cyclists. There is a relatively cheap and plentiful bus service. There's a tram service that runs straight through the center of the city. The urban rail is improving all of the time, and all of the economic benefits that flow from that are gradually working their way out through the system.
I was in St. Peter's Square in Manchester, I guess, a month ago for an event with our supporters, and I sort of sat down briefly before I went into the meeting, and it was extraordinary. I mean, it is, you could have been anywhere in Europe for exactly the reason you describe. And the loudest thing you could hear was the hum of the trams and this conversation of children going home from school. And you think, well, that's and actually birdsong, like, you know, because they have little kind of planted areas. You think, well, that's extraordinary. But on the other hand, not so extraordinary, because that's how great cities look and feel, right? And so we know what it needs to look like when it's in place. The question is, how quickly can we put it in place? How quickly can we fund and finance it? How quickly can we deliver it? Because once you're in it, you're like, this is, you don't even know. You just instinctively, this is great. I'm really glad I'm here. So the more that we can reproduce that in, not just in big cities, but in market towns, in, you know, all over the country, I think the quicker we can do that, the better.
For sure. So just before we go, Ben, the Integrated National Transport Strategy, what's happening?
Yes, well, it's interesting, isn't it? This is the first thing of its kind for over 25 years since John Prescott's white paper back in 1998. I think it's very positive that the government's committed to producing an integrated national transport strategy. I know that Danny Williams and his team are beavering away, processing the huge amount of information and data they got from both the consultation and from the roadshows they ran. It's going to be very interesting to see what the integrated national transport strategy says, and if you like, how integrated it is. So, for example, what might it say about the relationship between transport and land use planning, so that we put new developments in the right places to reduce the need to travel and to promote sustainable travel? What might it say about the relationship between transport and other areas like health, social care, etc.? And of course, what might it say about how to make sure that the transport system is itself fully integrated in terms of buses and trains and taxis and cycling and walking all connecting together and being easy and comprehensible to you. So I'm going to be very interested to see what they come up with. I think a good integrated national transport strategy will then set the framework for all the decisions about investment, what the city regions and local authorities do, very much in the way that the Mayor's Transport Strategy in London provides that framework for decision making, both by TfL but also for the local authorities in London. So I think if it can do that, then it will have been a real success.
Yeah, I think that's tremendous. When are we expecting? Do we know?
Well, I don't actually know what the current public statement on that is. I think later this year, but I don't really know what that means.
No, indeed.
I don't know whether they're trying to get out before the summer recess. If they did, it would
That'd be
be an amazing
amazing.
achievement. Yeah. But I think, you know, I think my sense is they're very keen to get it out as quickly as they possibly can, because, as I say, it should then provide the framework for lots of other things that will flow from it.
Yeah, for sure. Hey Ben, that's been tremendous. As always, fantastic to see you. We don't normally get half an hour to chat. Actually, we normally only get 10 minutes or so or see each other across a crowded room. So it
Yeah.
has been really tremendous. And my guest has been Ben Plowden, who is the chief executive of the Campaign for Better Transport. You'll find them at bettertransport.org.uk. So please do check up on their website for all the work that they're doing, and in particular about Better Transport Week, which is from the 16th to the 22nd of June, which is a whole series of wonderful events across the country, culminating in a conference in Manchester. Lunch with Leon is produced in association with Passenger Transport Magazine. You'll find them at passengertransport.co.uk. And I look forward to having you all back with another guest here on Lunch with Leon very soon. In the meantime, Ben, really good to see you as ever.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And this was Lunch with Leon. Your host was Leon Daniels, and our guest today was Ben Plowden, who is the chief executive of the Campaign for Better Transport. Lunch with Leon is produced in association with Passenger Transport Magazine. PR support is from Stark Communications. Guests speak freely and don't get paid, so you can believe what they say. Feel free to share this podcast widely and give us a rating however you can.